Okay, good evening, everyone, and Chodesh Tov, I guess we can still say that, even though it's no longer Rosh Chodesh, but happy Beis Nisan. So I wanted to speak about tonight the history of Charoses, and in particular the reason why this is such a pertinent and, I think, important topic is because of the fact that when you take a look, you know, we have the Seder night less than 2 weeks away, and on the Seder night, you have all of these different mitzvos, all of these different practices that we're doing, right? This night is different than all other nights, as we say in the Manish Tana. And many of the aspects of the Seder, we are expecting or anticipating from the text and the Torah, from how the Psukim phrases what we're supposed to be doing on Pesach, or even from, rabbinic teachings, if you will. Think of the mitzvos like matzah and the dalakosos, and, you know, even things as simple as dipping the vegetable, you know, karpas, and washing our hands with the bracha or without the bracha. Even though there's so many additional and new aspects on Seder night that we don't do the rest of the year, there's an order, and no pun intended, a Seder to all of it. When it comes to Charoses, it's sort of this entity that makes its way onto the Seder night. It's on the Seder plate. It's something that we are very aware of what it is. However, it seems to be a little bit unclear. However, it seems to be a little bit unclear exactly where it comes from, what role it's meant to play in the Seder night experience, and what its importance is for each and every one of us. So my goal is to sort of just try and focus and understand a little bit about the history of Charoses, understanding whether or not it's a mitzvah, is it an obligation, is there a source to the mitzvah, or is it just something that we started doing 1 year and we never stopped? What's the significance in particular of the ingredients, right? I imagine if we would compare all of the different family recipes of Charoses of everyone on this Zoom call, I imagine there probably would be some level of similarity, if not nearly identical, but different cultures and different sects of Judaism do have different ingredients. So what is the significance of the ingredients and of Charoses, eating it or having it on the Seder plate in general? Number three, why is it that the ingredients seem to differ between different groups of Jews? And finally, how exactly are we supposed to partake of Charoses on the Seder night, right? When it comes to all the other mitzvos all the other practices that we have at the Seder, even if there are arguments as to how much matzah to eat or how much grape juice or wine to drink, everyone knows that you have to eat a certain amount. Is there a measurement of how much Charoses we need to partake of? Right? Some Haggadahs will say you just dip it in and shake it off. Other Haggadahs might say, you know, or other people might just take like a whole spoonful of Charoses and start lathering it on their korech sandwich. How much are you supposed to eat? And what is the origin of either custom, whether just dipping it and shaking it off, or lathering it on real thick and nice? So those are our goals, and hopefully we'll be able to get to everything. There is a lot of information here, and in particular, there is an amazing book that I had a taiva to get, I think, last year or 2 years ago when it came out, but I only bought this year, and that's why I'm excited to give this class. It's called Charoset, the book, and it's about the history. It's written by Susan Weingarten. It's a fascinating book, definitely worthwhile to take a look at some point. But so a lot of the sources that I have here come from that book, that's a lot of where a lot of it is sourced from. But anyway, so let's begin. Let's jump into the conversation. Let's take a look first at source number one. Source number one is the Mishnah in Psachim, in the 10th chapter, the 4th Mishnah, quoting the famous text of the Manish Tana, Shebechol halaylos anu matbilin pa'amachas, halayla hazesh shtei pa'amim. Every night of the week, or every night of the year, we dip once a night. And the Gemara talks about, what do you mean, when do we normally dip? So that's a question the Gemara deals with. But the Mishnah is saying over here that we normally dip once, whatever that once is. Tonight we dip twice. What are the two dippings that we do? Well, one of them is the karpas, the vegetable that we dip in the salt water, and the other seems to be when we dip the maror into the charoset. It's part and parcel of the text of the Manish Tana. And if you take a look at source number two, where does the Manish Tana get it from? Where is the source? Actually, where does it come from? Well, It comes from the Mishnah in Pesachim on Daf Kuf Yud Dalet Amud Aleph that Hivinu Lefanav, they bring to the person, they bring to the people at the Seder, Metabel B'chazeres Ad Shemagil Parperas Apas, they dip this Chazeres a little bit, and then Hivinu Lefanav Matzah V'chazeres V'charoses U'shnei Tafshil, and they bring before them the Matzah and the Chazeres and the Charoses. They bring the Charoses. Here's the source. They bring Charoses at the Seder. Afal pi she'in charoses mitzvah. The Mishnah says, even though eating charoses or having charoses at the Seder is not a mitzvah, nonetheless, they do bring it to the Seder table. But Rabbi Elazar ben Sadok Omer, mitzvah, no, there actually is a mitzvah. So we see from here in this Mishnah, in source number 2, there's an early machlokas, there's an early argument among the rabbis, among the Tanaim, whether or not charoses is a mitzvah. Some people say it is a mitzvah. That's Rabbi Elazar ben Sadok, who says that it's a mitzvah. And others seem to say that, no, it's not a mitzvah at all, it's a custom at best. If you take a look, though, at source number 3, the Gemara is going to question, well, if it's not a mitzvah, according to the opinion who says that it's not a mitzvah, then why do we do it? We don't just do random things. We don't just, I don't know, eat an orange every Wednesday because we feel, I mean, we do it because we feel like it, but we don't subscribe a religious significance to it. So why are they bringing charoses according to the opinion who says that it's not a mitzvah? Take a look at source number 3 of the Gemara in Pesachim, Kuf Tes Zayin, Amud Aleph. Afal pi shein charoses mitzvah, okay, so v'i la mitzvah, mishum mai maisila. Why do they bring it to him if it's not a mitzvah? So now the Gemara gives several different explanations. Rabbi Ami says, mishum kappa. Rashi explains, what does it mean, kappa? Well, the understanding is, and there are several explanations given, but we'll just go with Rashi for now, and he explains basically that the maror is so strong, it's so bitter, it's almost poisonous to the person who is partaking of it, and therefore he needs to have some sort of a sweet dish to counteract the horrible bitter taste, and therefore they have charoses in order to nullify the strong taste of the maror. It does seem to imply as well that the maror must have been something really bitter and really strong. That's for all those people who use horseradish as their maror, that's a good source for you. Those are people who use lettuce, like myself, for the maror. It seems to be a little bit odd how sharp, how bitter could the lettuce have been if they need charoses to dull it out. But nonetheless, that is what the Gemara says. You eat charoses not because there's an obligation, but because of the fact that you need to do it to nullify the horrible, bitter tastes of the maror. If you skip down another 2 lines in that Gemara, in the middle of the 3rd line, Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzaduk Omer, so my mitzvah, according to Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzaduk, who again, he in the Mishnah said there was a mitzvah to eat it, so what is the mitzvah? What is the nature of the commandment? Rabbi Levi says, Zecher latapuach. It's a remembrance for the apple. What apple? So immediately our heads begin to, the gears in our mind begin to turn a little bit. We'll get back to that in a second, but one person says it's a remembrance for the apple, which, by the way, is a good source for many of us Ashkenazim who have apples in our charoses, seems to be based on this idea. Rabbi Yochanan Omer, Zecher Latit. No, Rabbi Yochanan says it's actually a remembrance for the clay, for the mortar that they use to make the bricks. That's why charoses looks very brown and pasty, because it's meant to be a remembrance for the mortar that was used in Egypt. Amar Abaye, Hilkach Tzarich Lekahoye, Vitzarich Lesamoche. So Abaye then introduces this rule over here. He says, in order to fulfill both opinions, the one who says that it's like the tapuach, and the one who says that it's like the mortar, he says, here's what we do. Lekahoye zeche letapuach, in order to make it a zeche letapuach, in order to make it a remembrance for the tapuach, we have to make it tart. It's a little unclear over here. If tapuach really does mean apple, then apples usually are not acidic or they're not very tart. So what does it mean we have to make it tart? So some people explain that tapuach doesn't mean apple. It actually means like a citrus fruit. I think Rabbi Soloveitchik held that. So in other words, it's not an apple, but we shouldn't have apples in our charoses. We should have like lemons or oranges in our charoses instead. So that's what we have to do. We have to make it acidic. V'tzarech l'samoche zeich l'tit. And we also have to make it very thick so that it could be a remembrance for the mortar. And then Tanya Kavasi Derbi Yochanan, there's a Mishnah, there's a Braisa that was taught like the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, that Tavlin Zecher LaTevin, why do we add all the spices that we add to Charosis? Well, that's a remembrance for the straw. When they used to make the bricks and they used straw to build them, that's a remembrance for the straw, and Charosis Zecher LaTit. And the Charosis itself, well, that's a remembrance for the mortar. And then Amar Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Tzadok, Kachayu Omrim Tagire Charach Shabbi Yerushalayim, Bo'u Tlu Lachem Tavlin LaMitzvah. According to the opinion of Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Tzadok, who again says that it is a mitzvah to eat charoses, well, the Gemara says that this used to take place, that the people who used to run the shops in Yerushalayim, they would scream out, come and take spices for yourselves for the mitzvah. What mitzvah? For the mitzvah of eating charoses. So, in short, to sum up what we've seen thus far, is that there are those people who say that eating charoses is a mitzvah. Some people who say eating charoses is not a mitzvah. If you assume that it is a mitzvah, what is the mitzvah? So some people say it's a remembrance for the apple, which we'll have to get back to. Other people say that, no, it's a remembrance for the mortar and the clay that the Jewish people used to form the bricks to make the pyramids or whatever they were making in Egypt. Now, take a look at source number four. Source number four is the pasuk, is a pasuk in Shir HaShirim that we're led to understand is what the Gemara is basing itself off of when we say that it's Zecher LaTapuach, that it's a remembrance for the apple. The pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, Mi Zos Olam in Hamidbar, who is she that comes up from the desert? Misrapekes Al Doda, Tachas HaTapuach, Orarticha Shama, Chiblascha Imecha, Shama Chibla Yalad. Right. So who is this? Who is she that comes up from the desert, leaning on her beloved under the apple tree? I aroused you, and it was there that your mother conceived you, and there she who bore you conceived you. So in other words, there are those that explain that when the Gemara says that it's a remembrance for the apple, the notion is and the idea is that it's alluding to this pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which talks about the fact, at least according to one perspective, that we were redeemed from Egypt. When the Jewish people are redeemed from Egypt, we're referred to like an apple or connected to apples. So again, going back, why do we have charoses? It's Zecher LaTapuach. It's a remembrance for the fact that we were taken out of Egypt. So again, the Gemara then brings us essentially two ideas. One opinion says that we have charoses because it's a remembrance for the apple, which reminds us that we were taken out of Egypt. And another opinion says that it's a remembrance for the mortar and the clay that we used to make the bricks. Now, let's understand how we assume. In other words, so there's an argument in the Gemara, but that doesn't stop there in terms of helping us determine what we would follow. In other words, is charoses a mitzvah? Do we assume that it is a mitzvah or not? Which opinion do we follow? And obviously, it's a machlokas, it's an argument. According to Tosfos in source number 6, which would represent the Ashkenaz, and therefore most of us, I think all of us on this Zoom call, so Tosfos says as follows, Mashma to halacha k'Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok. He says it seems that the law is like Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok, which would mean that eating charoses is an actual mitzvah, not just a, you know, just a nice cute thing that we do, that we used to make with our bubbies, and it tastes delicious. No, it's an actual mitzvah to eat charoses. The Rambam, which again would represent more of the Sephardic perspective, seems to contradict himself. We have two different opinions of the Rambam. In source number 7, in his Perush Mishnayos, in the explanations that he wrote on the Mishnah, so it seems that over here, take a look inside, the source number 7, Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok Omer, Charoses Mitzvah, the Daito, Shechayev Adam Levarech, Asher Kedishonu B'mitzvosa V'tzivanu Alachilas Charoses, Ve'ina Halacha. The Rambam says that according to the opinion who says that it's a mitzvah to eat charoses, well, if it's actually a mitzvah to eat charoses, then you should make a bracha. You make a bracha on maror, you make a bracha on matzah, so you should make a bracha on charoses as well. But says the Rambam, luckily, we don't hold that it's a mitzvah, and therefore you don't have to make a bracha. However, in source number 8, the Rambam seems to do a full 180 over here, because he says Hacharoses mitzvah v'divrei sofrim. It actually is a mitzvah. It's a rabbinic commandment, not a Torah commandment. We know it's not a Torah commandment because it's not written in the Torah, but it's nonetheless a clear rabbinic commandment. And Zecher Letit, it's a remembrance of the mortar that we used to have, that we used to make the bricks in Egypt, etc. And then and the Rambam actually gives his own recipe, which we'll read right now because it will be relevant for the end part of this year. The Ketzad Osin Osa, how do you make charoses? Lokchen Tamarim O Grogaros, you should take some dates or some like figs. Oh, simukin v'chayotze behen v'dorsin osan. You should beat all these fruits up. V'nosin l'tochan chometz, and you put vinegar in them. Metavlin osan betavlin kimotit, and you should put the spices in them to make them like a thick mixture over here. And anyway, so this is the recipe that the Rambam gives. The Rambam, not only does he double as a halacha sefer, but he also doubles as a cookbook, evidently, because he gives the recipe for charoses, which, by the way, he's not giving us a recipe because he wants us to hear how his bubby used to make charoses. He's giving it to us because he's assuming, as we'll see later, that there's halachic significance to the ingredients that are put in charoses. But I would venture to say that many of us don't have most of these ingredients that the Rambam has in their charoses, because most people don't follow this in this room, in this Zoom room, do not follow the Sephardic perspective of how to make charoses. Okay, but anyway, so we see from here again, Tosfos says it is a mitzvah to eat charoses, and there's a contradiction in the Rambam. How do we make sense of the contradiction? On the one hand, he seems to say it is a mitzvah, and on the other hand, he seems to say that it's not a mitzvah. So in source number 9, there's a beautiful explanation given by Rabbi Chaim Jachter in an article that he quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he says that Rabbi Soloveitchik takes these two opinions of the Rambam and he makes sense of it and sort of ties them all together so that they don't contradict themselves and they actually can live along side by side. How so? Take a look at source number 9. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik explains the conceptual basis for the Rambam's change. In the commentary to the Mishnah, the Rambam believed that Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok thought that it is a mitzvah to eat charoses. Accordingly, Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok would require us to recite the bracha of al achilas charoses on charoses. The Rambam, in turn, does not rule in accordance with Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok, since a practice the Rambam observed that no one recites a bracha on charoses. In the Mishnah Torah, on the other hand, the Rambam believes that Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok does not understand the mitzvah of charoses to be one of eating the charoses. Rather, the mitzvah is to have the charoses present on a Seder table to enhance the recounting of the Exodus from Egypt and to be available for dipping. In other words, it's a slight nuance over here. There is no mitzvah to eat the charoses. There is a mitzvah to have the charoses as a centerpiece on the table, put it on the Seder plate, and let it be something that we can look at, and maybe we'll take a dip here and there, but to eat it, okay, again, you'll dip a little bit, maybe you'll have a taste, but the point is not to eat it, it's to have it at the Seder table. Hence, even according to Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok, we don't recite a bracha on charoses, since there's no maisa, meaning there's no action. Usually the general rule is, we only make a bracha when there is an action. So when we shake the lulav, before we shake the lulav, we make the bracha. When we put on tefillin, we make a bracha before we put on tefillin. When we eat the matzah in the maror, we make a bracha before we do it. But when it comes to charoses, if the mitzvah is not to eat it, but rather to just put it on the table, that's a very passive commandment. And therefore, we make no bracha on it. So again, in other words, there is a commandment to have charoses at the Seder table, but not to eat it. You can dip a little bit, you can taste a little, a nibble, but the eating is not a mitzvah. It's just mostly meant to be there as a centerpiece. And therefore, we paskin, or at least there seem to be different practices, but the general understanding, according to the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, and the Mishnah Berura, is that we don't really eat it. We just should take a little dip in the maror or whatever it is and shake it off. Take a look at source number 10. How does the Shulchan Aruch describe eating charoses? He says, "Achar kach yikach kizayas maror." Take a little bit of maror. V'sheyik anu kulo becharoses. He says, "Dip it all the way in the charoses. Don't be shy. Dip it all the way in." V'lo yishenu b'tocho shelo yitbatel ta'am miriraso. He says, nonetheless, even though you should dip the whole thing in, don't leave it in there too long, because if you leave it in there too long, then the bitter taste is going to get very dull. Mitamze tzarich lina'er hacharoses me'alav. He says, as a result, you have to shake off all the charoses, because we don't want you to get rid of any of the bitter taste. And he says, you eat the maror without any sort of charoses on it. Just again, dip it in there for a second. The whole idea is, remember, just a remembrance of the clay or whatever it is, but not actually anything deeper than that. There's no obligation to eat it. And the Mishnah Berurah explains further when it comes to the korech sandwich as well, when you make your beautiful korech sandwich with the matzah and the maror, as we know, zecher the hillel, this is what hillel used to do in the times of the Beis Hamikdash. HaMikdash. So, the Mishnah Berurah says, remember, don't put too much charosis on there. You dip it in the charosis and you shake it off. But you know, you see these people at the Seder, they take like they have like a little piece of, like a little piece of maror, like a, you know, like, could barely see it, and they put like the whole that whole little bowl of charosis from the Seder plate, they put the whole thing on. So that seems to certainly not be where we're going with that. At best you could take maybe a little bit, but ideally it seems like the custom would be to dip it in and really just shake it off. Then I will say, as a disclaimer, that the Seder night is all about tradition in general. So, you know, charosis is one of these things, as we are already seeing, that it's kind of neither here nor there. It's a mitzvah, but it's also not maybe such a mitzvah to eat it. And so if you want to do it, and your tradition, you saw your grandparents and your great-grandparents all put 10 layers of charosis on, then, okay, it seems like you probably can do that. But again, people should be aware that there are actually halachic requirements of how much matzah and how much maror, and not with charosis. So better to have probably a little bit more of the matzah and the maror than the charosis, if not a lot more than the charosis. But nonetheless, here is what we see as framed according to these two sources, that it's best to shake it off. Now, let's go back one second. We mentioned a few moments ago that charosis is in memory of a few different things. One perspective in the Gemara was that it's in memory of the tapuach, of the apple, that the Jewish people that we were taken out of Egypt and we were compared to an apple. Another perspective was that it's in memory of the clay or the mortar that we used to make the bricks in Egypt. And another perspective is, and this seems to be part of that previous one, is that it's, the spices in the charosis are meant to be a remembrance of the straw that we used to make the bricks in Egypt as well. It seems, though, that there is one additional connection to what charosis is a remembrance of that we don't talk about that much. It comes up in a number of the sources, and we're going to mention it now. But again, you usually don't learn about this so much in high school and even at the Seder, unless you're more keen to the historical perspectives of charosis. It just doesn't come up too often. Let's take a look at source number 12. What does the Torah have to say? The Torah says in source number 12, the charosis hu zecher latit. Fine, we know that already. The charosis is a remembrance for the mortar and the clay. Shehayu avosinu mishtabin bo, the lekach tzarech la'asuso av zecher latit. He says you have to make your charosis thick so that it reminds us of the mortar that they had in Egypt. Umidvaram chamutzim, it has to be made from like vinegar type of food, acidic food. Zecher lemaror, so that it's a remembrance for the maror. V'isa b'Yerushalmi, and now listen to this. He quotes the Gemara in Yerushalmi that is da avid la ava, v'is da avid la racha. Zecher ledam. Some people make it thick. Why do they make it thick? Well, we make it to remind ourselves of the clay and the mortar. Other people, he says, make their charosis very thin. It's like a liquid, almost like a soup, maybe. Why? As a remembrance of the blood. The blood, which blood are we trying to remember? A little unclear. Well, one possibility is that we're meant to remember the blood from the first of the plagues, Makas Dam, and so maybe we're supposed to trying to remember that. Other perspectives might be that we're trying to remind ourselves of the Korban Pesach, right? Putting the blood on the lintels. Maybe that's what we're reminding ourselves of. But there is this other perspective that you have to make it thin, make it liquidy, to remind ourselves of the flowing blood that we had in Egypt. Upirish harav yichil, tahav ha'isa mitchila, Osinosa ava v'acharkach merachachinosa b'chomitz v'nosin ba'tavlin. So then the Torah says there are those that like to do both. They like to have it thick and thin in order to remember both of these ideas, that it should be like clay on the one hand and that it should be like blood on the other hand. So you make your charosis first very thick, like a paste, and then you add lots of vinegar, or as we'll see, there are other customs to add lots of wine to make it nice and red and blood-like, and that's how you make it thick and thin. And the Rama also says in source number 13, or Moshe Israelis, v'charosis yaseh av zecher letit, that you should make it thick like cement, like mortar, v'acharkach nosnin bo ma'at chome soyayin edom zecher ledam. And he says, then you should put in some blood. God. So you should put in some wine or some vinegar as a remembrance for the blood. Someone was listening to this out of context. It's not going to sound too good. But yeah, you put in some liquid, whether it's wine or vinegar, in order to make it a remembrance for the blood that we experienced in Egypt. Again, like I said, likely the remembrance is the blood from the Korban Pesach that was painted over the lintels of the doors during Makas Bechoros. Now, Many people are not aware of this Yerushalmi, and most people are just assume that we have charosis because it looks like cement, it looks brown, it looks like a brick, or it looks like paste that would go between the bricks, and so most people don't give a second thought that it should be comparable to anything else. Why does it feel that maybe this remembrance to blood was sort of lost? It's like, you know, people don't really talk about it too much. And so in the book Charosis that I've been referring to, she makes the following connection, the following statement. Take a look at source number 14. She says as follows. The Jews of Arles were also accused in 1453 of killing Christian children and making charosis with their blood. Right, many of us may be familiar with the blood libels that took place in many different Jewish communities throughout Europe, and most of us are familiar that the blood libels were originally about us using the blood of Christian babies to make matzah. Most of us don't realize that that's also applicable to charosis, that we told the community that we were making charosis a zecher ledam, a remembrance for the blood in Egypt. What better way, say the Christians who hate the Jews, to make this charosis a remembrance for blood than by having some good old-fashioned real baby blood in there? And so that's what we were accused of. Fortunately, the case was brought before the king, who gave them a fair hearing, and the Jews of Arles were cleared of the baseless accusation. And then she goes on, you feel free to read it on your own, but basically she continues that says there were a number of communities that experienced such anti-Semitism that they were maybe put on trial or accused of putting baby blood in their charosis, and no one wants to be caught in a situation like that. So it seems like this narrative of calling a charosis a remembrance of the blood in Egypt was sort of just, brushed under the rug because we didn't want to create any more anti-Semitic fodder for those who don't like us. So we said, okay, it's just Zecher the Tit. And again, I think that's probably why most of us are only familiar with that first idea, that it's a remembrance for the mortar, and we don't really talk about too much that it's a remembrance for the blood. There's also an additional perspective that why don't we talk about the fact that it's a remembrance for the blood, because that's just not how it developed, in that most of us have thick charosis. Those are the recipes that our families have been passing on for so many generations, perhaps even exclusive to the blood libels. We just always made thick charosis, and you can't get away with saying that your thick, clumpy charosis is a remembrance for the blood, so we just assumed that it was a remembrance for the clay, and we didn't think any more about it. But nonetheless, it probably is likely that it can all be traced back to all these blood libels, that we wanted to totally avoid ourselves from looking bad, and so we then said, let's forget about the blood comparison, let's just make it totally like the clay comparison. Okay, we're doing pretty good on time. A few more brief ideas, and then we'll sort of try to wrap it up. If you take a look at source number 15, we're not going to read through all of this, but it's another excerpt from the book Charosis. And in the book, she makes the following point, that there are a lot of individuals who take the various ingredients of charosis and say what they're a remembrance to. So charosis as a whole, it looks like brown mortar, and so it's the remembrance of the when the Jewish people were building with it in the desert. And there are those people who put the tapuach, and again, we went through all these reasons several times already. However, she says, the author of this book, that there are those who believe that there is a much deeper significance to charosis. In other words, we have to look beyond the simple ingredients, and we have to look even beyond perhaps the physical texture of the food charosis and realize that it stands for much more than what meets the eye. So again, take a look at source number 15, and I there are a few boxes over here, but I put arrows where I want you to look. So take a look where that first arrow is. It's like five lines down into that first paragraph on the left. And she says as follows, we saw how the Rashbats saw charosis and its spices as an allusion to earlier, even mythical times, the Garden of Eden, the Golden Age when the temple still stood, and to future messianic times. So here she quotes one idea, that charosis, forget about the various allusions and that the ingredients might show you, might give you, take a look at charosis as a whole, and in some way, shape, or form, something, perhaps it's the sweetness, the honey taste of the charosis, it reminds us of it reminds us of the Garden of Eden, and it reminds us of positive, happy times for when our Beis HaMikdash was standing, and it even makes us think of the future Geula, the future redemption. That's what charosis is meant to embody for us. How is it? It seems to be a little bit dachuk, not such a clear parallel. It makes a lot more sense to say that it's a remembrance for the mortar. Again, because we don't really find too many of these other more lofty parallels, right? No one says that the matzah is representative of the bread of freedom that we'll, you know, have in the times of the Geula. So it's an interesting parallel, but nonetheless, that is what the Rashbatz seems to say. Go down to that next arrow over there, where she quotes the Arizal. Now, this is a really, really interesting idea because those who are maybe a little bit more cynical and skeptical will immediately say that this doesn't seem to make too much sense. But let's take a look what we see over here. So she quotes the Ari. The Ari is quoted by his Kabbalist pupil, Rabbi Chaim Vital, in his Sefer, the Pre-Eitz Chaim, based mainly on the Ari's oral teachings. And Rabbi Chaim cites the Ari as talking about Charoses Evan and Charoses Eitz, right? So Evan, the Hebrew word for stone, and Eitz, the Hebrew word for tree. Now go to the paragraph on the right. Go to the top of that over there. One second, where are we? Yeah. Charoses, according to the Ari, is made mainly from three ingredients: apples, pears, and nuts, whose initial letters in German, or as he calls it, the language of Ashkenaz, Apfel, Birin, and Nuss. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but okay, you get what I'm trying to say. Spell the word Evan, A-B-N, or stone in Hebrew. So in other words, what the Arizal said is that you have the German words for these three ingredients in the Charoses. And the Rosh Tevos, the abbreviation of the German words, when parallel to the Hebrew language, spell out the Hebrew word Evan. A very complicated idea why that should bear any significance. Who cares what the German names for the words are and why that should be connected to Hebrew? Unclear, but that's what he says. We saw in chapter 3 that 15th century German illustrated Haggadah shows these ingredients, and okay, fine, whatever, etc. Go to the next paragraph. It is curious indeed to find a Sephardic rabbi citing an Ashkenazic version of Charoses using German vocabulary, and we may wonder about his source, but it seems to me that the mystical significance overrides mundane questions of locality and custom. Charoses Evan and Charoses Eitz are lisping puns on the biblical phrases Charoses Evan and Charoses Eitz, the carving of stone and carving of wood, terms used in the Torah that we read this past week, in this past week's Parsha, to describe the work of building the Mishkan and the Tabernacle. Right? So this is the language that the Torah speaks in when we talk about building the Mishkan and building the various Kelim, and therefore what the Ari is doing over here is, let's keep reading, the Ari has taken these words, which refer to the Tabernacle, as a reference point for the ingredients of Charoses. We have seen how Charoses through the ages has been interpreted as a memory of the clay and blood used in the bricks which built the cities of the pagan Egyptians, but the Ari transforms the blood-soaked clay used to build idolatrous Egypt into the materials for building the Tabernacle, the earthly home of the Shekhinah, the seat of the divine presence. So what does Charoses remind us of? Reminds us of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Unbelievable. Now let's take a look at one final idea. Go down to that paragraph beneath the one that we just saw. And she quotes Rav Nachman. Rabbi Nachman's oral teachings were recorded by his pupil, Rabbi Natan Steinhardt. Rabbi Natan writes often of Charoses in his collection of Rabbi Nachman's sayings. His ideas are based on word plays, on the word Charoses itself. The Hebrew letters in the word charoses can be rearranged into the words chas and root. Chas means have mercy, while root is the name of the biblical character Ruth, the ancestor of King David and hence of the messianic line. Thus, for Rabbi Nachman and his Hasidim, Charoset is a symbol of God's redemptive mercy in the past and heralds the future coming of the Mashiach. So, in other words, in essence, what are these last few perspectives of what Charoset is meant to remind us of all about? Some people say it's meant to remind us of the Beis HaMikdash. Other people say it's meant to remind us of earlier days of what the sweetness of Gan Eden was like. And another perspective is that it actually reminds us of the coming of the Mashiach because of the contraction of the word of Charoset. You break it up, it reminds us of Chas and Ruth, that Hashem should have mercy on the lineage of Ruth, that he should bring Mashiach to come very speedily in our days. Okay. With that, we now have one final question, and that is trying to understand the significance of some of the ingredients and understand where this all comes from. So there's a lot to do over here, and it could get a little technical and boring, so I'm only going to go through the initial understanding of it, and I brought some additional sources that you should feel free to take a look at more extensively on your own, if you'd like. But here's what we have. There are a few different basic ingredients that different sects of Judaism have used throughout history. Ashkenaz, like we said, uses apples. Seemingly, it's going way back to the times of the Gemara when it says it's a zecher latapuach, a remembrance for the apple. So many Ashkenaz people will not dream of making their charoses without apples. There are those who only specifically will use like a bitter herb or like an acidic aspect of their charoses. And I think I mentioned at the beginning that Rabbi Soloveitchik said that we should probably use some sort of a citrus fruit, and I think Rav Schechter does that as well, because that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik said to do. And then there is the Sephardic perspective that we quoted in the Rambam earlier, that they'll use dates and raisins and things like that. So let's take a look at source number 16, in which, again, this from this book Charosis, where she explains some of the various different sects, what they used to use. Overall, looking at the different sorts of modern charoses in Jewish diaspora communities, it's clear that there is a geographical distribution. Apple-based charoses is used by Ashkenazic communities, now including much North America. Date-based charoses is used by most Sephardic or Mizrahi communities, including Jews originally from Iraq, Iran, North Africa, and Yemen, as well as Spain and Portugal. The Iraqis and the Iraqi diaspora communities in India make almost the same charoses as Rav Sajid Gaon in the 10th century, although they leave out the vinegar. Other Sephardic communities have their own particular additions. Persians, for example, use pomegranates, and in the transitional area of the Balkans and Greece and Turkey, charoses is often raisin-based, using black raisins. These practices are clearly related to the availability of the fruits, and because dates do not grow in Ashkenaz. In other words, what she's saying over here is that at the end of the day, it seems to be that in all likelihood, there are so many different allusions and connections that you can make with the charoses, that what they probably did was very simple. They said, okay, listen, what fruits are available here? So in Ashkenaz, they had apples galore. And because they had apples, that's what they used to make their charoses out of. In the more Sephardic communities, where apples might not have been so common, they said, okay, let's see, what do we have? Oh, we have dates. Let's use some dates. And here's what the connection, oh, they're brown also. They look like, there's so much that you can connect to. And similar to how we view karpas, right? How you have some people use celery, some people use parsley, and some people use like a potato. I think some people use bananas, and they're actually met anyone who uses a banana, but there are some people who, it's one of the customs brought down, you could use a banana in theory, I think. And it comes from the fact that whatever your family tradition was, it came from what was available. So charoses seems to be the same thing, that whatever was available, that's what you used. But take a look at this last paragraph over here, which I think is fascinating, and that is not what charoses is made of, but who makes the charoses? Who in your household traditionally always made the charoses? So I grew up, my grandmother, my mother's mother, always used to make charoses, I remember. I think in a lot of households, that's probably the case, that the woman of the house makes charoses, which for a lot of people, for better or for worse, does not mean anything, because the wife usually cooks most of the food. So the fact that she should make the charoses is not so different. Again, not trying to stereotype, but speaking in somewhat the generalizations of the people, what people do. But she brings down this whole idea that there are some groups of Jews that the man specifically makes the charoses. And in fact, she writes that in some areas it was more common for the man to make charoses, and that there are two reasons given. Some, and neither one of them sounds great, but I'll give you both of them and realize, just take it with a grain of salt. Some people say that the men should be the ones who make it, because it's such a serious commandment to have the proper, to have charoses made properly. Can't imagine having a woman make it, so it has to have a man make it. Again, I'm not saying any, it's not my opinion, I'm just quoting. There is another opinion that, again, this makes the man look worse, so hopefully this will stay in the memory of all the women that are here, men can make the charoses, because men have no idea how to cook. So give them the easiest thing, charoses, you just follow the recipe, an apple and a nut or whatever, and that's it. But the brisket, whatever, that the woman has to do. So the men do the charoses because it's so easy to make the charoses. Okay, but now let's look at Shalom Bias' perspective. Let's see what she writes inside in this last paragraph over here. Again, still in source number 15, but that third paragraph. We have seen, perhaps surprisingly, that in the traditionally conservative Yemenite community, it is common for a husband and wife to make charoses together. This practice presumably stems from the Yemenite interpretation of the passage from the Jerusalem Talmud that, as noted in chapter 1, refers to charoses under the same name as the Yemenite Jews call it, duke, and can be interpreted to read, "She grinds it with him." So if she's grinding it with him, that means that she has to make the charosis and he has to make the charosis. They make it together. This indeed is how the authoritative Yemenite Rabbi Yosef Kappa reads it in his edition of the Haggadah. So here we see sometimes some cultures have women doing it and some sects of Jews have men doing it, whereas the Yemenites seem to have it the best, and that is they create a date night for the men, for the husband and the wife, that they should make their charosis together, and this should be a beautiful food and a representation of a house of unity, if you will. In source number 16, which again, we are not going to go through all of it because there is a lot here, but I found a fascinating article which really just breaks down what all the different groups do, and there's even more than this. But let's go through it very quickly. I bolded some of the ingredients of each one. So in source number 16, in one, where it says Ashkenazi charosis, so the classic Ashkenaz charosis, again, apples, walnuts, cinnamon, honey, Manischewitz wine, that's the classic. Number two, the Spanish Sephardic charosis, so pears, pistachios, figs, and walnuts. That's what she would say is the classic. That's what this author would say is the classic. Italian charosis, pine nuts, pears, and almonds. Again, because this is all based on what is most common in these areas. Number four, Piedmontese charosis. I don't actually know where that is, but somewhere in the Alps. There's lots of nuts in that area, so they use chestnuts and other walnuts. And then five, Moroccan charosis, dates, walnuts, and cloves. Chinese charosis. I have to ask a Chinese Jew, I don't know. But evidently there's soy sauce and pine nuts and honey and the like. And okay, you could read through it. Fascinating different ingredients that are used in all of these different cultures of Jews in their charosis. Ultimately, to bring it all together and to sum up and try to have some takeaway, I think it's clear that charosis, on some level, whether it's a full-blown commandment that to eat the charosis and you should make sure you have a shear, you should make sure you have a kazayas of charosis, that's probably not the case. But there is some clear obligation to eat or to have charosis at the table, just by the fact that this is what we've been doing for so many thousands of years. It certainly has its sources in the Mishnah, and it's meant to be at the Seder table, and it's impossible to have a Seder without charosis. In fact, this author, Susan Weingarten, in her book Charosis, she notes that in the times of the Holocaust, that in the ghetto, if you look at some of the Haggadahs from those times, you don't see charosis in a lot of their Haggadahs. It's just totally absent. And in other words, what she tries to explain is that in the times of the Holocaust, Rachmana Litzlan, they didn't have the availability for some of these things. So they had they can get a little matzah and a little flour and water together to make matzah, and they could get some grape juice or wine, whatever. But charosis, these were more exotic foods, and they were not able to make them. So we don't think of it as a luxury, but charosis is indeed a luxury, and it helps us remember both the pain that the Jewish people experienced so many thousands of years ago in Egypt, and also, God willing, as we saw, the times of redemption and what will come, God willing, when Mashiach eventually comes and the Geula, the redemption comes. And so ultimately we then find that charosis is meant to be a food that connects the past to the present, that it connects what all the horrible things that we experienced as a nation so many thousands of years ago, and God willing, all the positive and amazing things that will take place soon in our days. So this year, in just a little less than 2 weeks, when we sit down to have our charosis, whether we just dip it in, like again, it's probably the more classical way of looking at it, or we lather it on and pile it up to have almost as much charosis as we do maror and matzah, however we eat it, we should have in mind to put all of this to practice, that it's a remembrance for all of the bad that we experienced, that, as we know it from the Seder night, the bad that we experience is meant to enable and encourage and empower us to accomplish so much good, which will ultimately lead to the future redemption, God willing, speedily in our days. I wish everyone a beautiful night and a great week to all.